Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Diana Gabaldon, who reads from and discusses her new book, Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade, published by Delacorte. In the weeks to come, we have Garrison Keillor, Nancy Horan, Robert Fulghum, Michael Korda, Terry Pratchett, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. And thank you for silencing your cell phones. You'd be surprised how many authors have raced to silence their cell phones. We're so happy to have one of our favorite authors with us once again. A master of historical fiction, Diana's Outlander and Lord John Grey series have not only been huge sellers in English, they've been translated into 19 other languages and are sold in 23 countries. Lord John and the Hand of Devils is scheduled for release on November 27th of this year. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the author of Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade, that I think is now number 10 on the Times bestseller list, right, Diana? Diana Gabaldon. Gabaldon, excuse me. I misspoke. The book is number 8 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, thanks so much. It's awfully nice to see all of you tonight, and thanks for coming out on a, looks like a windy but pleasant summer evening. You could be outside, you know, flying around. Back in the day when I used to go out and do book signings early on, I'd come back in the evening and say to my husband, "Oh, we had a great crowd tonight. We had 18 people." We've expanded a little since then. Though even back then, he'd say to me, "Well, doesn't it make you nervous having to go out and talk to total strangers about your books?" I said, "Well, it might, save that I've been a university professor for a long time now. If I can keep people awake at 8 o'clock in the morning talking about human anatomy and physiology, I can probably keep them awake at 8 in the evening if they came on purpose to hear me." Back in the day, I would talk to auditoriums full of 300 or 400 people, because human anatomy and physiology was a popular science elective. Everybody took it, including the football team, because they thought it would be easy. And so I'd come in the morning, and the football team would all be sound asleep in the front row, these big inanimate blobs of flesh. And I'd walk up to the edge of the platform and say, "Well, this morning, gentlemen, we're going to discuss the history of contraception." And they'd all start blinking. I'd say, "In days of old, when knights were bold, and condoms not invented, they wrapped old socks around their cocks, and babies were prevented." Well, it worked on the football players, too. Now, people usually say to me, "Well, how did you get from being a scientist to being a novelist?" I said, "Well, easy, I wrote a book." I mean, that's all you have to do. They don't make you get a license, which is lucky, or that would rule out quite a number of novelists, I know. Now, I had always wanted to be a writer from a very early age, but I came from a very conservative family background. My father was fond of saying to me, "Well, you're such a poor judge of character, you're bound to marry some bum." He said, "So be sure you get a good education so you can support your children." So with this going on at home, I thought, well, perhaps I won't announce that I want to write novels, since I did know this was not a very stable profession. And instead, I went into science. You know, I liked science. I was good at it. I enjoyed it to a point. My first job post-doctorate was one where I butchered seabirds for a living. I didn't actually have to kill them. Luckily, someone in Canada hunted down these gannets and eider ducks and things like that, froze them, and sent them to me in Philadelphia. It was my job to thaw them out and then dissect them into 15 different components, which could be analyzed for fat, protein, and water analysis. And amongst my life skills is the ability to dissect a full-grown gannet. These things look like turkeys with a 6-foot wingspread. Anyway, I can take a full-grown gannet apart in 3 hours. This is unfortunately not a skill I've ever found any other use for. People do say to me, well, do you use your scientific background in your novels? I say, well, yeah, but probably not the way you're thinking. No, I actually, you know, I know what it feels like to disjoint something or to, you know, hack it with a large blade. Those things are tough. Gannets, as I say, are huge birds, and they're diving birds. They dive from 40 feet up and hit the water head first. Consequently, they have heads like concrete. And I had to get the brains out to process those, so I had to get the head off, which is where I learned how to break necks. You know, it's you don't just want to go, arrk, because that doesn't work. You have to sort of turn it first and go, arrk. <In that one. laughs> Yeah, and then I would have to use a hammer and chisel actually to extract the brain. So, you know, the battle scenes in my books, you actually do have some sort of a basis in reality. You know, I know what it's like to stab something, you know, and hit a bone when you weren't expecting it. Yeah, well, as I say, was a scientist for some years, and starting with a doctoral dissertation on nest site selection in the pinion jay, Gymnorhinus cyanocephalus. Or as my husband says, why birds build nests where they do and who cares anyway. Yeah, this was followed, as I say, by the seabird butchering postdoctoral appointment. Then I had one at UCLA, where I was actually substituting for a principal investigator on sabbatical. So I ran his lab, including his 6 graduate students and his 2 Russian exchange scientists. That was an interesting job, in that the FBI was following his Russian exchange scientists. Whenever one of them left, they'd come around and interrogate me. But after that, my husband got a better job in Arizona, and I said, well, I'd love to go back to Arizona. It's where I grew up, but only if I can find a job. So I went to interview at Arizona State University, and the fact that I am now a published novelist has something to do with the fact that Arizona State University hired me without a job description. I went to interview, and they said, well, the legislature has given us money for this position. If we don't use it, they'll take it away again, so you're hired. They said, we don't have anything actually for you to do, but we would like you to invent your own research program, and while you do that, you can help Bob here, the assistant director, with his data. They said, Bob's got 10 years' worth of data in cardboard boxes in his office. They said, you have a computer background, by which they meant I had 1 class in Fortran programming. But it was 1 more than any of them had. And so they said, you can help Bob get his data into the computer. This was the mid-80s when they thought you unscrewed the top and poured the data in. So I spent the next 18 months of my life writing Fortran programs to analyze the contents of bird gizzards. That's what Bob did, you know. The upshot of this was an 800-page monograph on the dietary habits of the birds of the Colorado River Valley. You might see a sort of increasing trend here, 400-page doctoral thesis, 800-page monograph. Hey, what's next? Well, anyway, no, I did not marry a bum. I married a very nice man, but he did quit work 3 months after our first child was born in order to start his own business. And I do have to admit that in terms of financial stability, there's not that much to choose between an entrepreneur and a bum. So for several years, I was, in fact, the sole support of the family. And so I was looking for ways and means of earning a little extra money, because they don't pay assistant professors that much. And I began saying, well, you know, what can I do would earn extra money. Well, owing to these Fortran programs that I had written, what I said to myself at the conclusion of this was, there's maybe five other people in the whole world who are interested in bird gizzards, but it would save each one of them 18 months worth of effort if they knew about these programs I've written. Why is there no venue by which we can share this kind of information? Well, the short form here is that I actually started a scholarly journal called Science Software Quarterly, which was for scientists who use computers in their work. And this kind of flowered into a set of international seminars. And anyway, at the time of which I speak, I was a, quote, expert in scientific computation. It's real easy to be an expert if there's only six people in the world who do what you do. So when the need to earn extra money arose, what I did was to send out a query letter to the computer press, to Byte and InfoWorld and PC Magazine. Mind you, this all does have something to do with how I became a novelist. And along with it, I sent a copy of my Science Software Quarterly Journal and a copy of a comic book that I had done for Walt Disney's Educational Media entitled Nutrition Adventures with Orange Bird. Well, it was a real short query. It said, "Dear sirs, as you can see from the enclosed, you won't find anyone who knows more about scientific and technical software than I do, and at the same time can write so as to appeal to a broad popular audience." Well, it's got immediate results, and within a year I was making as much freelancing as I was from my university job, which, as I say, just goes to show how little they pay professors. So anyway, at this point, I had just turned 35. I had two full-time jobs and three children under the age of six. And what I said to myself was, well, you know, you're 35. I said, Mozart was dead at 36. If you want to write a novel, you better get started. So in spite of the two full-time jobs and the three small children, I decided to start writing a novel. And so I said to myself, well, up to this point, I've written everything anybody would pay me for, including all the things you have to get, have to write to get an academic degree. And no one has ever showed me how to do any of this, from comic books to dissertations and to monographs. You know, I just wrote some, and if it didn't look quite right, I poked it till it did. Well, fine, I said. You've been reading novels for 30-odd years. Surely if you write one, you will recognize it. And so I said, okay, I'm going to write a novel just for practice. I'm not going to show it to anyone. It's not for publication. I just need to learn how to write a novel. And once I know how, then I can decide if I want to do it for real. Okay, so this is a practice book. What's it going to be? And I thought, because I read everything and lots of it, and I said, well, maybe read more mysteries than anything else. Maybe I'll write a mystery. I said, no mysteries have plots. I don't know if I can do that. And so I said, what's the easiest possible kind of book to write for practice? Well, I thought some more, and I said, well, for me, perhaps that would be a historical novel. Historical novels have no genre constraints. You can do anything in the context of a historical novel, from the autobiography of Henry VIII, very fact-based, oriented on a real person, down to very light, fluffy historical romances, some of which actually have very little history in them, and up through, you know, the less fluffy kind of World War II thrillers, political intrigue, anything, as long as it has a very convincing, believable background that will pull people into the past, make them believe they're there. Well, the way that you get this effect is to have very vivid, convincing details, which, of course, you get from research. And I said, well, great, I'm a research professor. I know what to do with the library. I said, it seems easier to me to look things up than to make them up. And if I turn out to have no imagination, I can steal things from the historical record, which actually works very well. So I said, fine, historical novel. Well, the next question, of course, is where are we going to set this putative novel? Because I have no background in history, just the 6 hours of Western civilization they make you take as an undergraduate. So I'd have to look up everything anyway. And so I was looking for a good time and place to set this, and I happened to see a really old Doctor Who rerun on public television. I see some of you are familiar with Doctor Who. For those who are not giggling, it's a really old, long-running show that's done in Great Britain, and it's a fantasy show done for kids. In the U.S., of course, it's a cult, and we have Doctor Who conventions. But the premise is that the Doctor of the title is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey who travels through space and time having adventures, and along the way he picks up companions from different periods of Earth's history. Well, in this really old show, he had picked up a young Scotsman from 1745. And this was a 17, 18-year-old kid who appeared in his kilt. And I said, well, that's kind of fetching. And I found myself still thinking about this the next day in church. And I said to myself, well, you know, you want to write a book, it doesn't really matter where you set it. The important thing is pick a point and get started. So I said, fine, Scotland, 18th century. So that's where I began, knowing nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, having no plot, no outline, and no characters. Nothing but the rather vague images conjured up by the notion of a man in a kilt. Which, as you will all admit, is a very profound and compelling image. You know, the last Outlander novel that I wrote, A Breath of Snow and Ashes, was a very fortunate novel, amongst other things. It actually won an international literary prize, which was very gratifying. And I had to go to Germany to get this because they were televising the awards ceremony out of Berlin. Well, while I was there, the German publisher had arranged for me to be interviewed over and over and over again all week. And toward the end of the week, I was talking to a gentleman from their literary press, and he was just raving about the books. And he was saying, oh, you know, your narrative drive is wonderful and your imagery, your characters, they're so vivid. And I was thinking, yes, yes, go on. And good interview. And he said, there's just this one thing. I wonder if you could explain to me, what is the appeal of a man in a kilt? Well, he was a German, you know. And I was very tired, or I might not have said it, but I just looked at him for a minute and I said, well, I suppose it's the idea that you could be up against a wall with him in a minute. Well, a few weeks later, I got a wad of press clippings from my German trip. I can read German, but very slowly. And the top one was from this gentleman. It had a post-it note from the publisher on it. She said, I don't know what you told this man, but I think he is in love with you. Yes, well, anyway, back to the computer stuff. There's a reason why I write long books. It's because I like digressions. But anyway, as I say, I'd sort of become an expert in scientific computation, was writing software reviews and all this. But one day, a Byte magazine sent me a subscription to CompuServe along with the review copy of a software they wanted me to do. And they said, this company has a support forum on CompuServe, which is one of the big information services. Mind you, this was the late 80s, it was, or mid-80s. It was long before America Online. There were no chat rooms. The World Wide Web didn't exist as such. But there were these few information services. And CompuServe was about the biggest. And they said they would like you to check out the support forum and mention it in your review. I said, great. So I went and checked. Well, after this, I had 4 hours of free Connect time. And this was back when Connect time cost $30 an hour. So I said, okay, don't want to waste it. What else is in here? So I began poking around, and I discovered a group of people called the Literary Forum. Well, these were people who liked books, you know, and there were some published writers there, some aspiring writers. There were a lot of people who just read books. But, you know, it was the ideal social life for someone with two full-time jobs and three small children. So I began logging in, you know, periodically as I worked during the day just for a break. It's still running, a bulletin board system. People leave messages that are addressed to a specific other person or to everybody, but anyone can read the messages and reply to them. So you get these evolving conversations, which essentially just stay in place. Well, when the idea to write a book came to me, I was not going to tell anyone what I was doing, including these people. I'd been hanging around with the Lit Forum for a year or so by then. I wasn't telling my husband either, because he would have tried to stop me. Not out of any desire that I not write a book, but out of fear that I would kill myself from overwork. So I didn't tell him. Anyway, I was not going to tell these people either, because I'd seen a lot of people come into the Lit Forum and sort of talk about what they were going to do, and then they'd never do it. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm not going to tell anyone until I've actually done something. So I didn't. I had been writing along for about 8 months, I suppose, when I found myself one night, you know, logging in periodically while I was working, and I was having a desultory argument with a gentleman online about what it feels like to be pregnant. And he said, oh, I know what that's like. My wife's had three children. You notice it's all the women laughing. And well, I laughed too. I said, yeah, Buster, I've had three children. And he said, well, can you tell me what it's like? I said, I can, yes, but it's sort of complex. I don't know if I can squeeze it all in a 30-line message here. I said, I tell you what, though, I have this thing I wrote a few months ago in which a young woman tells her brother what it's like to be pregnant in some detail. I'll put that in the library here, and you can go read it. Well, so I did, and everyone who had been following the argument went and read this piece. And they all came rushing back and said, well, this is great. What is it? And I said, I don't know. And and they said, where's the beginning? And I said, I haven't written that yet. And And they said, well, you know, put up some more of it. We want to know more about these people. Now, I don't write in a straight line, and I don't write with an outline. I write in bits and pieces that kind of coalesce as I go along. But whenever I would have 5 or 10 pages that were coherent and didn't take a lot of information, I would put them up in the library. And this was every 2 or 3 months. So people would read these chunks, as they called them, and they'd say, oh, Diana has a new chunk. Have you read it yet? And everyone would go read it, and they'd come back and ask me questions. And anyway, this went on for several months, and people began saying to me, well, this is great. They said, you should try and publish it. And I said, well, I don't even know what kind of book it is to start with. It was a perfectly straightforward historical novel for about 3 days. But as I say, I knew nothing about Scotland or the 18th century, so I went immediately to the library to check this out. And I found all these books on Scotland, which I was looking over. But I said to myself, the important thing here is not to learn everything there is to know about Scotland in the 18th century. The important thing is to learn how to write a book. So I said, I'm going to start doing the writing immediately while I do the research. And, you know, if I write something and it turns out to be wrong, I'll just change it. Not a problem. So all I knew about writing novels was that they should have conflict. Well, a quick glance at Scotland in the 18th century was enough to show me the Bonnie Prince Charlie in the 45. This was conflict, you know. I said, okay, good background here. I said, now I must have a lot of Scotsmen because of the kilt factor, of course. But I think it would be a good idea if I had at least one female character to play off these guys. Then we'd have sexual tension. That's conflict. That's good. And so I said, well, we have Scots versus English. If I make her an English woman, we will have lots of conflict. And so about the third day of writing, I introduced this English woman. And I had no idea who she was, what she was doing there, how she got into the story. But I loosed her into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. Well, she walked in. They're all crouched around the hearth muttering. And they turned around and stared at her. And I was thinking, why? Does she look funny? What's going on? And one of them drew himself up slowly, and he said, well, my name's Dougal Mackenzie, and who might you be? And without my stopping to think, I just typed, my name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you? I said, well, you don't sound at all like an 18th century person. So I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like an 18th century person. But she wasn't having any of this. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks. And she also took over and started telling the story herself. And so I said, well, I'm not going to fight with you all the way through this book. I said, no one's ever going to see this. It doesn't matter what bizarre thing I do. Go ahead and be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later. So it's all her fault that there's time travel in these stories. Well, so when my friends began encouraging me to publish this book, I said, I don't even know what kind of book it is. I mean, there's the Loch Ness Monster and all these other kinds of things in it. I said, but out of curiosity, what should I do? Well, the published authors that I knew all said, get a literary agent. They said an agent can get you read much more quickly than if you're sending it to a slush pile. And if it does sell, an agent can negotiate a much better contract than you can do. This is true. Literary contracts are just truly Byzantine. My first one ran 12 pages of clauses, and it's only owing to the skill of my first agent that I still have my t-shirt rights and my action figure rights. My husband says he can't wait to see the Black Jack Randall action figure. Well, anyway, I said, yeah, how do you find an agent? You know, and they gave me advice, and I began doing research and zeroing in on this one gentleman named Perry Knowlton, who seemed as though he would be a good match. He was a very well-known agent, represented a lot of best-selling authors, and I had learned that he was not afraid of long books, and he didn't mind unorthodox books, both of which it had struck me I had. And so I thought he'd be a good match, but didn't know how to get at him, because he didn't take unsolicited queries. But I went on asking questions, and about 6 months later, I was chatting with a friend of mine named John Stith, who writes science fiction mysteries. And I said, well, I'm asking everybody about agents, John. Do you have one? He said, well, yeah. He said, by coincidence, is the same as so-and-so. His name's Perry Knowlton. He said, I know you're almost ready to look for your own agent. Would you like me to introduce you to Perry? I said, well, that would be nice, John. Yes. Well, I was afraid John would be run over by a bus or leave CompuServe. So I said, yes, go ahead and ask him. And so he sent Perry a note saying I was worth looking at. Now, Perry was an older gentleman who I'm sure never touched a computer in his life. So this was just a plain paper and pen note. And I followed that with my own query letter, and I said, dear Mr. Knowlton, I've been writing and selling nonfiction by myself for some years now, but I am writing a novel, and I understand I really need good representation for this. I said, you've been recommended to me by John and Carolyn and all these people whose opinions I respect. I said, I have this very long historical novel. I don't want to waste your time. Would you be willing to read excerpts from it? I didn't tell him I wasn't through writing it. Excerpts were all I had. And he very kindly called back and said, yes, he would. So I hastily wrote a 26-page synopsis and sent it with my excerpts, and he took me on the basis of an unfinished first novel, which was great. Well, 6 months later, I finally finished writing the book, and I sent it to him, and I said, well, I've realized there's more to this story, but I thought I should stop while I could still lift it. The next week, I was going to New York myself for a conference, and so I said to him, well, I'll be in New York next week, and he said, oh, come up to the office so we can meet, because we'd never met face-to-face. We'd done it all by phone. So I went up next week in some trepidation of mind, because at this point, Perry was the only person in the world, other than myself, who'd read the whole book, and I didn't know what he thought about it. Well, he turned out to be a charming older man, took me back to his office, got me a Diet Coke, and was trying to put me at my ease. This wasn't quite as successful as he probably hoped, because he was telling me about his other clients. And it was at this point that I realized that in addition to my various best-selling friends, he also represented Tony Hillerman, Frederick Forsyth, and Robertson Davies. And I was sitting there thinking, if you have the nerve to call Robertson Davies Robbie, you're a better man than I am. But what was most unnerving was that he had my manuscript sitting on the desk in front of him in the big orange box in which I had mailed it. And I was sure at some point he was going to say, well, now that I've seen it, you know, there's really nothing I can do with it. It's just too weird, but, you know, keep me in mind. And I was expecting to hear this. Instead, he said, you know, the thing about Freddie Forsyth and Robbie Davies and those guys is that they're all great storytellers. And he laid a hand on the box and smiled at me and said, and you're another one. Well, thank you. Well, thanks. Well, at this point, of course, I didn't care what he did with it, but, but I did gather enough presence of mind to ask, and he said, well, I'm sending it out today to 5 editors who I think might like it. And, you know, he told me all about them, and I said, well, great, you know, how long do you think we might have to wait for an answer? You know, expecting 18 months, 2 years. He was saying, oh, I've told them I want an answer in 30 days. And I was thinking, well, you picked the right agent. So I went home to wait for 30 days. Well, 4 days later, I got a message on my answering machine. It was Perry. He said, I've just called to update you on your manuscript. And I thought, well, you know, of the 5 he sent it to, at least one has said, here, I'm not reading a 10-pound book, take it back. But instead, he said, well, of the 5 I sent it to, so far 3 of them have called back with offers to buy it. I said, well, okay. That was good. And so he was able to negotiate amongst them, and in 2 weeks he merged with a 3-book contract. You know, bing, I was a novelist. So in not very short form, that's how I became a novelist. Right. Well, I did bring some things to read tonight, just so you would feel you had been to a genuine literary event. Now, I have been reading bits and pieces of Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade, which is kind of traditional. On the other hand, I see that most of you actually have this book, and you can therefore take it home and read chapter 17 for yourselves. So I was going to ask, maybe I should tell you, to start with, that in fact there is another Outlander novel after Breath of Snow and Ashes. Oh, well, thanks. Thanks. I normally do work on 2 or 3 projects at once because it keeps me from getting writer's cramp and or writer's block either. And so I've been working on book 7. It hasn't got a working title yet, but I've been working on it during this last year while finishing Brotherhood of the Blade and all that. So I do have chunks of that. Would you like to hear a small chunk of that? Yeah, great. Okay. Or a large chunk. Well, you know, we don't want to be here all night. Some of you have books you want signed. Okay. Now let me rehydrate for a moment. All right. There isn't too much you need to know as background for this. It is set in Scotland, and we are in Jamie's point of view here. The place was shabby, but in decent repair, he grudgingly noted. There was a saddle mule browsing in the paddock behind the house, elderly but sound-looking. Well enough. There he wasn't spending his money on follies, or a coach and 4 at least. He set his hand on the gate and felt a twist go through his wame. The feel of the wood under his hand was eerily familiar. He'd lifted it without thinking at the spot where it was always inclined to drag on the path. That twist corkscrewed its way up to his mouth as he recalled his last meeting with Ned Gowan, Leary's lawyer. "What does the bloody woman want, then?" he demanded, exasperated. To which Ned had replied cheerfully, "Your head mounted above her gate." With a brief snort, he went through, closing the gate a bit harder than necessary, and glanced up at the house. Movement took his eye. A man was sitting on the bench outside the cottage, staring at him over a bit of broken harness on his knee. An ill-favored wee lad, Jamie thought, scrawny and narrow-faced as a ferret, with a wall-eye and a mouth that hung open as though in astonishment. Still, he greeted the man pleasantly, asking, was his mistress to home the day? The lad, seen closer to, he must be in his 30s, blinked at him, then turned his head to bring his good eye to bear. "Who are you, then?" he asked, sounding unfriendly. "Fraser, of Rock to Rock," Jamie replied. It was a formal occasion, after all. "Is Mrs.—" He hesitated, not knowing how to refer to Leary. His sister had said she persisted in calling herself Mrs. Fraser, despite the scandal. He hadn't felt he could object, the fault of it being his, and he being in America in any case. But damned if he'd call her that himself, even to her servant. "Fetch your mistress, if you please," he said shortly. "What do you want with her?" The straight eye narrowed in suspicion. He hadn't expected obstruction, and was inclined to reply sharply, but reined himself in. The man clearly kept something of him, and it was as well if Leary's servant was concerned for her welfare, even if the man's manner was crude. "I wish to speak with her, if you've no great objection," he said, with extreme politeness. "Do you think you might make shift to go and tell her so?" The man made a rude sound in his throat, but put aside the harness and stood up. Too late, Jamie saw that his spine was badly twisted, and one leg shorter than the other. There was no way to apologize that would not make matters worse, though, and so he only nodded shortly and let the man lurch his way off into the house, thinking that it was just like Leary to keep a lame servant for the express purpose of embarrassing him. Then he shook himself in irritation, ashamed of his thought. What was it about him that a hapless woman such as Leary McKenzie should bring out every wicked, shameful trait he possessed? Not that his sister couldn't do it, too, he reflected ruefully. But Jenny would evoke some bit of bad temper or hasty language from him, fan the flames till he was roaring, and then extinguish him neatly with a word, as though she doused him with cold water. "Go see her," Jenny had said. "All right, then," he said belligerently. "I'm here." "I see that," said a light, dry voice. "Why?" He swung round to face Leary, who was standing in the doorway, broom in hand, giving him a cool look. He snatched off his hat and bowed to her. "Good day to you. I hope I see you well today." Apparently so. Her face was slightly flushed beneath a starched white kerch, blue eyes clear. She looked him over, expressionless, save for her fair brows, which were arched high. "I heard you were to come home. Why are you here?" "To see how you fare." Her brows rose that wee bit higher. "Well enough. What do you want?" He'd gone through it in his mind 100 times, but should have known that for the waste of effort it was. There were things that could be planned for, but none of them involved women. "I've come to say sorry to you," he said bluntly. "I said it before and you shot me. Do you want to listen this time?" The brows came down. She glanced from him to the broom in her hand, as though estimating its usefulness as a weapon, then looked back at him and shrugged. "Suit yourself. Will you come in then?" She jerked her head toward the house. "It's a fine day. Shall we walk in the garden?" He had no wish to enter the house with its memories of tears and silences. She regarded him for a moment or two, then nodded and turned toward the garden path, leaving him to follow if he would. He noticed that she kept a grip on the broom, though, and was not sure whether to be amused or offended. They walked in silence through the kale yard and through a gate into the garden. It was a kitchen garden made for utility, but it had a small orchard at the end of it, and there were flowers growing between the pea vines and onion beds. She'd always liked flowers. He remembered that with a small twist of the heart. She'd put the broom over her shoulder, like a soldier carrying a rifle, and strolled beside him in no hurry, but not offering him an opening either. He cleared his throat. "I said I'd come to apologize." "So you did." She didn't turn to look at him, but stopped and poked her toe at a curling potato vine. "When we wed," he said, trying to retrieve the careful speech he'd thought of, "I should not have asked you. My heart was cold. I'd no right to offer you a dead thing." Her nostrils flared briefly, but she didn't look up. Just went on frowning at the potato vine, as though she suspected it might have bugs. "I knew that," she said at last. "I did hope." She broke off, lips pressing tight as she swallowed. "I did hope I might be of help to you, though. Everyone could see you needed a woman. Just not me, I suppose," she added bitterly. "Stung," he said the first thing that came to his tongue. "I thought you needed me." Her nostrils flared, and she looked up, her eyes gone bright. Christ, she was going to weep, he knew it. But she didn't. "I'd wains to feed." Her voice was hard and flat and hit him like a slap on the cheek. "So you did," he said, keeping his temper. It was honest, at least. "They've grown now, though. And he'd found dowries for both Marcelly and Joan, too. But he didn't suppose he'd be given any credit for that." "So that's it," she said, her voice growing colder. "You think you can talk your way out of paying me now, is it?" "No, that is not it, for God's sake." "Because," she said, ignoring his denial and swinging round to face him, bright-eyed, "you can't. You shamed me before the whole county, Jamie Fraser, luring me into a sinful match with you, and then betrayed me, laughing at me behind your hand with your Sassenach whore." I didn't. "And now you come back from America, fardled up like an English popinjay." Her lip curled in scorn at his good ruffled shirt, which he'd worn to show her respect, goddammit. flaunting your wealth and playing the great game with your ancient hussy, foaming in her silks and satins on your arm, is it? Well, I'll tell you. She swung the broom down from her shoulder and drove the handle of it violently into the ground. You didn't understand one thing about me, and you think you can awe me into crawling away like a dying dog and troubling you no more. Think again, that's all I'll say to you. Just think again. He snatched the purse out of his pocket and flung it at the door of the garden shed, where it struck with a boom and bounced off into a bed of snapdragons. He had just a moment to regret having brought a chunk of gold and not coins that would jingle, before his temper flared. Aye, you're right about that, at least. I didn't understand one thing about you. I never have, try as I might. Oh, try as you might, is it? She cried, ignoring the purse. You never tried for an instant, Jamie Fraser. In fact, her face clenched up like a fist as she fought to keep her voice under control. You never truly looked at me. Never, well, no, I suppose you looked once, when I was 16. Her voice trembled on the word, and she looked away, jaw clamped tight. Then she looked back at him, eyes bright and tearless. You took a beating for me. Ugh, do you recall that? For an instant he didn't. Then he stopped, breathing heavily. His hand went instinctively to his jaw, and against his will he felt the ghost of a smile rise against the anger. Oh, I do. Angus Moore had given him an easier time than he might have, but it was a fair beating nonetheless. His ribs had ached for days. She nodded, watching him. Her cheeks were splotched with red, but she'd calmed herself. I thought you'd done it because you loved me. I went on thinking that, Ken, until well after we'd wed. But I was wrong, wasn't I? Bafflement must have shown on his face, for she made that small in her nose that meant she was aggravated. He kept her well enough to know that, at least. You pitied me, she said flatly. I didn't see that then. You pitied me at Lyok, not only later when you took me to wife. I thought you loved me, she repeated, spacing the words as though speaking to a simpleton. When Dougal made you wed the Sassenach Corps, I thought I'd die. But I thought maybe you felt like dying, too. No, it's not like that at all, was it? No, he said, feeling awkward and foolish. He'd seen nothing of her feelings then. Hadn't seen a thing but Claire. But of course Larry had thought he loved her. She was 16. And would have known that his marriage to Claire was a forced one, never realizing that he was willing. Of course she'd thought she and he were star-crossed lovers. Except that he'd never looked at her again. He rubbed a hand over his face, feeling complete helplessness. You never told me that, he said finally, letting his hand drop. What good would it have done, she said. So there it was. She'd known, she must have known by the time he married her what the truth of it was, but still she must have hoped. Unable to find anything to say in reply, his mind took refuge in the irrelevant. Who was it, he asked. Who? Her brow furrowed in puzzlement. The lad. Your father wanted you punished for wantonness, no? Who did you play the loon with then, when I took the beating for you? I never thought to ask. The red splotches on her cheeks grew deeper. No, you never would you? The barbed silence of accusation fell between them. He hadn't asked then. He hadn't cared. I'm sorry, he said softly at last. Tell me, though, who was it? He hadn't cared then in the least, but found himself curious now, if only as a way of not thinking of other things, or not saying them. They hadn't had the past she'd thought, but the past lay still between them, forming a tenuous connection. Her lips thinned, and he thought she wouldn't say, but then they parted, reluctant. John Robert MacLeod. He frowned at a loss for a moment, and then the name dropped into its proper place in memory, and he stared at her. John Robert? What, him from Killiecrankie? Aye, she said. Him. Her mouth snapped shut on the word. He hadn't known the man well at all, but John Robert MacLeod's reputation among young women had been the subject of a good deal of talk among the men-at-arms at Lyoch in his brief time there. A sly, good-looking slink of a man, handsome and lean-jawed, and the fact that he'd a wife and wains at home in Killiecrankie seemed to hamper him not at all. "Jesus," he said, unable to stop himself. "You're lucky you kept your maidenhead." An ugly flush washed darkly over her from stays to cap, and his jaw dropped. "Mary Mackenzie, you weren't such a wanton fool to let him take your virgin to his bed." "I didn't ken he was married," she cried, stamping her foot. "And it was after you wed the Sassenach. I went to him for comfort." "Oh, and he gave it to you, I'm sure." "Hush your gob," she shrieked, and picked up a stone watering pot from the lock by the shed, hurled it at his head. He hadn't expected that. Claire threw things at him frequently, but Larry never had, and was nearly brained. It struck him in the shoulder as he ducked aside. The watering pot was followed by a hail of other objects from the bench, and a storm of incoherent language, all manner of unwomanly swearing, punctuated by shrieks like a tea kettle. A pan of buttermilk hurtled toward him, missed its aim, but soaked him from chest to knees with curds and whey. He was half laughing, from shock, when she suddenly seized a mattock from the shed wall and made for him. Seriously alarmed, he ducked and grabbed her wrist, twisting so she dropped the heavy tool with a thump. She let out a screech like a banshee and whipped her other hand across his face, half blinding him with her nails. He snatched that wrist, too, and pressed her back into the wall of the shed, her still kicking at his shins, struggling and writhing against him like a snake. "I'm sorry," he was shouting in her ear. "Sorry. Do you hear me? I'm sorry." shouting to be heard above the noise she was making. The Klishmaklaver stopped him hearing anything behind, though, and he had not the slightest warning when something monstrous struck him behind the ear and sent him staggering, lights flashing in his head. He kept his grip on her wrists as he stumbled and fell, dragging her down atop him. He wrapped his arms tight round her to keep her from clawing him again and blinked, trying to clear his watering eyes. "Free her, you bastard!" The mattock chunked into the earth beside his head. He flung himself over, Leary still clutched to him, rolling madly through the beds. The sound of panting and uneven steps, and the mattock came down again, pinning his sleeve to the ground and scraping the flesh of his arm. He jerked free, heedless of tearing skin and cloth, rolled away from Leary and sprang to his feet, then launched himself without pause at the weazened figure of Leary's servant, who was in the act of raising the mattock above his head, narrow face clenched with effort. He butted the man in the face with a crunch and bore him flat, punching him in the belly before they hit the ground. He scrambled atop the man and went on punching him, the violence some relief. The man was grunting, whimpering, and gurgling, and he'd drawn back his knee to give the bugger one in the balls to settle the matter. When he became dimly aware of Leary, screeching and beating at his head, "Leave him alone!" she was shrieking, crying, and slapping at him with her hands. "Leave him! Leave him! For the love of bride, don't hurt him!" He stopped then, panting, feeling suddenly a terrible fool. Beating a scrawny cripple who meant only to protect his mistress from obvious attack, manhandling a woman like a street ruffian. Christ, what was the matter with him? He slid off the man, repressing an impulse to apologize, and got awkwardly to his feet, meaning to give the poor bugger a hand up at least. Before he could manage, though, Leary fell to her knees beside the man, weeping and grappling at him, finally getting him partway sitting, his narrow head pressed to her soft round bosom, she heedless of the blood gushing from his smashed nose, petting and stroking him, murmuring his name. Joey, it seemed to be. He stood swaying a bit, staring at this demonstration. Blood was dripping from his fingers, and his arm was beginning to burn where the mattock had skinned it. He felt something stinging run into his eyes, and wiping it away, found that his forehead was bleeding. Joey, the open-mouthed, had evidently inadvertently bitten him when he'd butted the man. He grimaced with disgust, feeling the tooth marks in his forehead, and groped for a handkerchief with which to stanch the blood. Meanwhile, foggy as his head felt, matters on the ground in front of him were becoming clearer by the moment. A good mistress might try to comfort a wounded servant, but had yet to hear a woman call a servant, Mokhrid, let alone kiss him passionately on the mouth, getting her own face smeared with blood and snot in the process. he said. Startled, Leary turned a blood-smeared, tear-stained face to him. She'd never looked lovelier. Him? Jamie said incredulously, nodding toward the crumpled Joey. Why, for God's sake? Leary glared at him slit-eyed, crouched like a cat about to spring. She considered him for a moment, then slowly straightened her back, gathering Joey's head once more against her breast. "Because he needs me," she said evenly. "And you, you bastard, never did." Well, thank you so much for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Garrison Keillor, Nancy Horan, Robert Fulghum, Michael Korda, Terry Pratchett, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 7th, 2007.